Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was a top nuclear scientist, a husband, and a father. He was assassinated in a heinous terrorist attack in Iran on Friday. Condemnation of this terrorist act has been slow in coming from some Western countries. And why is that the case? Either they support terrorism or they don't. Either they are with the victims of terrorism or they are with the perpetrators. Is there a middle ground when it comes to terrorism?
2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept this car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered here outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of Detroit, Julia Kazem, journalist and writer. Out of the Netherlands, author, Uprising Today, Brett Jonkers. Thank you both for being with us. Let me start it off with Brett. Brett, we've seen yet another nuclear scientist in Iran assassinated in this terrorist attack. What do you think the main goal of this type of terrorism is?
Well, it's basically a continuation of something that has been happening for decades. In fact, even before the Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979, it was already spoken about by Sayyid Ayatollah Khomeini back in the day, in which he said that the enemy of the Iranian people, the enemy of the Islamic Revolution, mostly, of course, the Zionist entity and the United States of America, have a keen interest in disrupting any form of technological progress being made by the Iranian people, and not just by the Iranian people, but basically by the wider global South in total, because they have the idea, of course, that the global South, and especially nations that stand up against worldwide imperialism, that they should be completely dependent on the hegemonic powers for their technological progress, for their economy to function, for any sort of healthcare and also energy sufficiency. The idea, of course, that Iran is pursuing nuclear energy in order to be self-sufficient in terms of energy and electricity is a major threat for the sanction regime that is in place against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Of course, if you want to sanction Iran and if you want to destroy the country economically, the more self-sufficiency and autarky that Iran achieves by itself will undermine, the more this plan will be undermined. So there is a keen interest, both economically and ideologically, by the Zionists and the imperialists in the United States and in the West in general, to undermine whatever plan Iran has to make sure that they can produce their own nuclear energy and would no longer be dependent so much on fossil fuels, for example.
Julia, Iran has said that Israel has committed this crime. I want your perspective on that, and how likely is it that the United States has also been involved, in your perspective?
Yes, they definitely work in concert with one another, Marzia. Israel has waged considerable influence on the IAEA, the United Nations Atomic Energy Watchdog Unit. Since for the past 20 years at least, they have been pushing the narrative through the MEK terrorist organization that Iran's nuclear energy program, as Brett described, which is critical in transitioning Iran from fossil fuels and further developing its economy in a sovereign manner, is a, you know, absurdly illegal way that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons. The United States itself, in its own investigations, knows that Iran does not have an atomic nuclear weapons program. However, its narratives the narrative that is pushed by the United States and Israel through the IAEA keeps on still assuming that, it's at least pursuing a nuclear weapons program through its development of nuclear energy. And that is the narrative that has basically gotten us to this point. In 2002, the MEK terrorist organization pushed that assertion, and then within a year, the United States responded by putting a additional sanctions and diplomatic aggression against Iran. And even considering that by standards of the Western backed so-called international community, Iran has abided by all international agreements and has been a prime agent and leader in nuclear non-proliferation. It is a signatory and member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which Israel is not a part of. And it shows by even their standards, Iran is abiding by all standards of nuclear non-proliferation, which Israel doesn't,
okay,
because it wants to retain its hegemony in the region.
Stay with me, Julia. I want to pick up on what you said when I come back to you. But, Brett, when examining the situation in Western and Central Asia, many analysts and politicians say most of the instability can be traced back to the United States and Israel. Your take on this?
I think this is most definitely true. There is a lot of U.S. meddling going on, of course, in the Middle East in general, in the Arab world, in Central Asia. But the same, of course, goes for the Zionist entity. And we've seen more and more that the Zionist entity of Israel has been working, has been charting its own course, has been working sort of separately from the United States, and has because they know that they can always, no matter what they do, they can always drag the United States presidency and administration, the Pentagon, CIA, and as a consequence, very often also the U.S. public opinion into whatever conflict that they are creating. So this is something that you see here. You see the responses by a lot of even mainstream politicians in Europe and even in the United States who are seemingly quite shocked. Of course, they don't dare to go as far as to condemning it or calling it an act of terror. But this leads me to believe that this is most likely indeed some sort of a relatively solo operation, or maybe something that happened only in concert with the highest echelons of U.S. society, led, amongst other people, of course, by Mike Pompeo, in order to strike once again against Iran before the Donald Trump administration runs out its course at the end of this year. So when you see these attacks taking place, not this year alone, Iran has suffered the death, the martyrdom of two major figures of its country, of course, Brigadier General Qasem Soleimani being the first one, and Dr. Mohsen Farizadeh being the second major one. This is an obvious showdown, let's say, that the powers that be, especially in Israel, they do not want a softer approach be taken towards Iran, a diplomatic approach towards Iran by, for example, the United States. I think the Israelis are getting scared that Joe Biden could continue the policies of the late Obama presidency regarding signing potential peace treaties or other agreements.
Well, Brett, let me just jump in here, because there are analysts saying that there's a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. But when we look at it, well, Julia, I'll throw this back to you now. When we look at actually American policy, one, in dealing with Israel and also in dealing with Iran, if we look at from the beginning of the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979 up until now, we see a certain consistency of American policy to continue to pressure Iran. Under the Obama administration, actually, that's when several of the nuclear scientists had been assassinated. So is there really a difference between American administrations, Republican or Democrats, when it comes to their main policy on Iran, which is trying to put pressure on it, and many would say trying to overthrow the Islamic Republic?
Yeah, I agree. There is not a difference. Maybe a slightly in the short term, there is a difference in an approach with the Republicans pursuing it and Netanyahu kind of in line with a more hardline strategy in the short term. But we have to remember, as you said, the four nuclear scientists that were assassinated between 2010 and 2012 were assassinated under Obama's term. The drone strikes across the region expanded under Obama's term. And the JCPOA had put Iran under the assumption of guilt that it was pursuing nuclear weapons. So it was under the same basis, and still would put punishing metrics on Iran should it develop its nuclear capacity for its own energy needs beyond that. And also a lot of the intelligence gathering that went to the IAEA, it's under suspicion that may have had a role in exposing Iran to exposing Iran's information on its nuclear energy to these Western powers that work under these agencies. So there's a more diplomatic short-term strategy, but it's another means of hegemony ultimately.
Brett, we're hearing from some Western countries calling on Iran now to show restraint, while at the same time not condemning this act of terrorism itself. But why would a government think that Iran, the victim of such terrorist attacks, should show restraint now? And why wouldn't a government such as the UK condemn this terrorist attack?
Yeah, this is, in my opinion, this is a very clear example of double standards. It's the hypocrisy and the Western supremacist ideology that permeates all of Western society and politics, both left and right of the spectrum, and indeed, you know, in the United States, Republican and Democrat alike, the idea that, you know, whenever you attack a country in the Middle East, for example, Iran, they are expected to show restraint. They are expected to come to the negotiation table. They are expected to keep on bargaining. They are expected to sign agreements that take away part of the national sovereignty. Because let's be honest, the JCPOA by itself was actually a violation of Iran's sovereignty, because they had to give access to their nuclear energy facilities. They had to declare not to do certain things. They had to, indeed, as was said, as Julia said very, very concisely, they had to basically admit guilt for something they had never done, which is trying to pursue a nuclear weapon. But on the other side, of course, when you see an attack being committed against any sort of target, In the West, for example, this is immediately considered a major violation of all humanitarian law, and this was considered a ground for war. I think one of the best examples is that in my own native country of Belgium, when you look at Iran being talked about in the media, the murder of Dr. Farizadeh is only a very small item on the list, because in Belgium, when people talk here now about Iran, they're talking about this alleged plot that they have captured a bunch of Iranian Belgians who are suspected of having tried to commit an attack against an MEK meeting in Paris. And the MEK, which is one of the most prolific terrorist organizations in the 20th century, which has killed 17,000 Iranians in the past few decades alone, is now officially considered quote-unquote Iranian opposition in Armenia. So this alleged attack against terrorists who gather freely in France, in the streets of Paris, this possible attack that was maybe being planned is considered a bigger problem than the constant murders of Iranian people by Zionists and by American agents. So this is the typical double standards, the sickening double standards that has existed here for decades and is permeating all of our politics, all of our propaganda media. The idea, of course, that a nation that resists against imperialism, these people are considered to be basically subhuman. They might not say it in such way, not with that many terms, but when you really look further than the way they try to describe it, when you look further than the propaganda language itself, that's what it comes down to. The lives of Iranians or Iraqis or Libyans or Syrians or anyone basically living in Africa are considered to be of vastly inferior value than the lives of Westerners or of Western allies.
Well, Julia, after more than 40 years of sanctions on Iran, do you think those entities which have tried to overthrow the Islamic Republic are showing signs of desperation that they are initiating or continuing these types of terrorist acts? And does it show that the policy of maximum pressure on Iran has failed?
It absolutely does. The policy of maximum pressure is a regional strategy, like you said, of desperation, of having the Gulf countries, which are always covert allies of Israel, kind of come out into the open to receive their defense and military packages from the U.S. In an obvious escalation against Iran, as well as the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, of the nuclear scientists, show that there is no other recourse that the West can take in countering Iran except by unjustified acts of terrorism against top officials and top apparatuses of government and security. It is completely, they act completely impunity while doing this, which is perfect with your description of the West actually demonstrating terrorism in their approach to foreign policy. And one wonders why they constantly have to have the monopoly on violence and of force in an unjustified way. Now, Iran, if we're going to talk about restraint, Iran has gone out of its way to show restraint by barely even responding to any of the deaths and assassinations that have took place, not just in this year, but in the last 10 plus years. And its response to the sanctions have just been to develop its own internal economic, capacity in a way that it's more and more towards sovereignty from the Western axis. And then they get punished for that, too.
Well, Julie, let me just jump in here, because you just talked about being punished for trying to develop various things inside the country. And I want to look at that with all the pressure, with over 40 years of sanctions and so many different types of war, where we're talking about the 8-year imposed war or media wars or cultural wars, of course, that we have seen. What was key in your perspective that Iran has been able to progress and advance so well technologically?
Yeah, so technologically, I mean, even being in Iran, just seeing how they have been developing their own internal, technology applications, how they've still been able to, develop their medical field and their energy capabilities by reducing their dependency on oil so successfully is a testament to their economic sovereignty, their goals of economic sovereignty be achieved even under these conditions of extreme sanctions. And to see this approach taken by Iran to actually use sanctions and use this delinking from the West in their favor towards economic sovereignty has just been incredible and a testament to its objectives in doing so.
All right, let me get Brett in on this, because we're quickly running out of time. But Brett, what is key now, in your perspective, in dealing with this type of terrorism? There are some that say that these entities want war to begin with, or some say they're just trying to impede Iran's progress. But what is key, in your perspective now, in dealing with these type of illegal acts?
I think the key thing here is that you have to retaliate in a way that is of sufficient proportion, a response that will send a clear message that this Iran will not just roll over and accept these sort of attacks to happen, while at the same time, of course, always being wary of the potential lures, the traps that might be used to lure the country into an all-out war against any regional powers in the area or international imperialist powers. And I think this is very well summarized when the Rahbar said it, when Sayyid Khamenei said, we will not accept these dictates from the United States, nor will we go to war. You know, Iran has always been very good at finding this, let's call it a middle road, in which they do strike back, they do attack, they do help regional powers, other friendly nations, build up the axis of resistance, they do fight against the Zionist incursions, but they don't go openly to war, and they definitely do not initiate any conflict that can then later on be blamed on them. And I think this is the key strength, one of the key strengths of the Iranian Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Okay. Julia, 30 seconds, same question.
Yeah, exactly. So also Iran's development of a resistance economy, too, in line with this philosophy, where the economic terrorism, in addition to the military terrorism, is harnessed as a strategic node of enabling Iran to develop a sense of economic sovereignty, and also expanding it eastward to new allies, to neighbors. You know, it delivered oil tankers to Venezuela, developing relations with China, and across the resistance axis nations too, are a testament to its proactive approach.
Okay.
And
And on that note, so sorry, we're out of time. Appreciate both of you being with me. Out of Detroit, a journalist and writer, Julia Kazem. Out of Hazat, Brett Yonkers, author of Uprising Today. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Thanks so much for being with us.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Literacy, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alladhina ukhriju min diyarihim bighayri haqqin. ولولا دفع الله الناس بعضهم ببعض لهدمت صوامع وبيع وصلوات ومساجد يذكر فيها اسم الله كثيرا ولينصرن الله من ينصره إن الله لقوي عزيز.
They are those who have been evicted from their homes without right, only because they say, "Our Lord is Allah." And were it not that Allah checks the people, some by means of others, there would have been demolished monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques in which the name of Allah is much mentioned. And Allah will surely support those who support Him. Indeed, Allah is powerful and exalted in might.
So, dear listeners, in the previous program, we started talking about the 40th verse of this chapter. الَّذِينَ أُخْرِجُوا مِنْ دِيَارِهِمْ بِغَيْرِ حَقٍّ إِلَّا يَقُولُوا رَبُّنَا اللَّهُ. They are those who have been expelled from their homes without right, except that they say, "Our Lord is Allah." وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسِ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ. And had Allah not repelled some people by others, لَهُدِّمَتْ صَوَامِعُ وَبِيَعٌ وَصَلَوَاتٌ وَمَسَاجِدُ يُذْكَرُ فِيهَا اسْمُ اللَّهِ كَثِيرًا. Certainly, there would have been pulled down cloisters and churches and synagogues and the mosques in which Allah's name is much mentioned. وَلَيَنْصُرَنَّ اللَّهُ مَنْ يَنْصُرُهُ إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَقَوِيٌّ عَزِيزٌ. And verily, Allah will help him who helps him, for verily, Allah is strong and mighty. So in the previous program, we said that one of the clearest examples of being oppressed is mentioned in this verse, and it is vagrancy, to be expelled from your home. This is the very first right to have, and some people in the beginning of Islam were deprived of it. And of course, being religious and being the followers of true religion has been hard and has had its difficulties and hardships from the beginning. And as you can see, during the times we're living in nowadays, it's becoming harder and harder every day. But the difficulties were started and were caused by some oppressors from those early and beginning days. Because just a single mentioning the name of the Almighty Allah and saying Rabbuna Allah, as the verse says, because of this, they were deprived of their homes and they were made vagrants. Anyway, after talking about this point, the Holy Quran points to one of the philosophies of the religious aspect of the holy struggle and says, وَلَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ النَّاسِ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَهُدِّمَتْ صَوَامِعُ وَبِيعٌ وَصَلَوَاتٌ وَمَسَاجِدُ يُذْكَرُ فِيهَا اسْمُ اللَّهِ كَثِيرًا. And had Allah not repelled some people by others, certainly there would have been pulled down some cloisters, churches, synagogues, and the mosques in which Allah's name is much mentioned.
Yes, if the faithful and zealous persons remain heedless and simply watch the destructive activities of the tyrants, they just remain silent to the faithless, cruel persons, so that they find this scene without any opponent, there will remain no effect from the temples and centers of divine worship. These places are the sites of awareness, and sanctuaries are as battlefields, and a mosque works as a fortress against the self-interested ones.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
In principle, any invitation onto theism is against the arrogant individuals who desire that people may worship them in the same manner that they worship Allah. That is why, if they find an opportunity, the simplest opportunity to act against Islam and divine worship, they ruin all the centers of Islam, and of course, not sometimes Islam, any centers of divine worship, as the verse suggests. And this is one of the goals of the religious aspect of holy struggle and the leave for fight, because the names of the divine places are all mentioned in this verse, and it's not important for those who are oppressors, which religion they are related to. Sawami', bi'a', salawat, wa masajid. They don't care what they are, they just think about their own benefits. And as long as these places, as long as these centers of divine worship are acting against their benefits, they are trying to ruin them. So the Almighty Allah did give the right for the oppressed to start against the oppressors the fight, in order to stop these places, in order to stop these centers of the divine worship to be ruined. We will continue talking about this important verse, inshallah, in the later programs. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Round the World with Reporters.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader, and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this is era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics.
we are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not a Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi. In the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Mohamed Fazari, from Khartoum, Sudan, city of Omdurman.
p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack, while all indications attest to an Israeli involvement. Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases, ending on December 19th. Large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in past by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticised for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalisation, terrorism and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After a long hunger strike going beyond 100 days to protest against his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Maher al-Akhras has been finally freed. The Israeli authorities released al-Akhras from the Israeli hospital of Qablan, where he was held for subsequent worsening of his health condition. He arrived at Al-Najah hospital in the West Bank city of Nablus following his release by Israeli authorities. After final medical examinations, he was moved to his hometown, Silat al-Dahr, north of the occupied West Bank. In a press statement, al-Akhras thanked the Palestinian people for the solidarity actions and insisted that gaining rights and liberty are only achieved through fighting.
Praise be to God that I am now among my family and my people in Nablus, and that God willing, we will get rid of the occupation with the mighty wills of our people and live from victory to victory until we reach a greater victory and liberate Palestine.
Israel arrested al-Akhras in July over accusations of being a prominent member of the Jihad resistance group, which he denied. He immediately started his hunger strike demanding that he should either be prosecuted for clear charges or be released. Israel at first refused to deal with his demands, but when he was at the verge of death, the Israeli High Court ruled that if al-Akhras ended his hunger strike, his administrative detention would not be renewed upon its expiration on 6th of November.
prominent figures who rushed to welcome Al-Akhras praised his encouragement in what they described as defeating the occupation's authorities. Administrative detention involves no indictment, no revelation of confidential evidence, and no trial or judgment of the accusations against the prisoner. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are languishing in Israel's jails without charge or trial under the illegal so-called administrative detention. The inmates say their hunger strike is a bet to have their voice heard and to force the Israeli regime to end this illegal policy. Reports say more than 7,000 Palestinians are held in Israeli jails. Maher Al-Akhras has achieved victory through his hunger strike, and he's free today. Experts say his battle definitely gives other Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention a glimmer of hope, enabling them to go on with their actions and their fight for justice that aim to get back their rights in Israeli jails. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said in a report that Israel's prolonged blockade of the Gaza Strip and the regime's military operations against the Palestinian enclave had inflicted some $17 billion U.S. dollars in losses between 2007 and 2018. Richard Kuzel-Wright, the director of UNCTAD's Globalization and Development Strategies, said that it was extremely difficult to see anything but redevelopment being the fate of Gaza society. The Israeli regime has placed the Gaza Strip under a tight blockade since 2007 and waged three wars on it since 2008. The blockade and military operations had driven the poverty rate in Gaza to increase almost fourfold compared with normal conditions.
The losses that were highlighted in the UNCTAD report show the extent of damage caused by the Israeli blockade and wars against the Gaza Strip, especially the three major wars since 2008. Israel has systematically destroyed civilian infrastructure and economic sectors, in addition to the loss of innocent lives.
According to the UNCTAD report, Gaza has witnessed one of the worst economic performances globally. In addition to killing and maiming thousands of Gazans during the wars, Israeli forces also bombed civilian infrastructure, as well as thousands of factories and businesses.
The Palestinian economy in Gaza is collapsing because of the Israeli wars and blockade. Israel waged three major wars in less than 10 years and destroyed all aspects of our economy in Gaza.
As day laborers, we sustained heavy losses because of the wars. Factories were destroyed during the wars, and thousands of people lost their sources of income.
UNCTAD says its estimates are partial because they cover only the economic cost of the Israeli occupation from the prolonged closure and recurrent military operations in Gaza from 2007 to 2018. Experts say the Israeli regime must be held accountable for its illegal policies against the Palestinian people.
Israeli military aggressions and the blockade amount to war crimes, and the international community must bring an end to Israel's impunity. The Palestinian Authority and human rights organizations must also include the economic file in their complaints at the International Criminal Court because Israel perpetrated war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Observers say that for Gaza's economy to slightly recover, the blockade must be fully lifted. According to UN figures, the Israeli regime is responsible for the near collapse of Gaza's regional economy and its isolation from the Palestinian economy and the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Sudan's former premier Sadr al-Mahdi dies from the novel coronavirus at the age of 84. Al-Mahdi was Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was transferred to the United Arab Emirates for treatment but succumbed to the illness nonetheless. The government declared 3 days of national mourning for his passing. Al-Mahdi was born in 1935 in the city of Omdurman and grew up during the last two decades of British imperial rule on Sudan. He became the country's prime minister in 1966, but his term did not last long as he was ousted in 1967 by a coalition of defectors. Later in 1986, Al-Mahdi was elected again as premier, but was toppled once more in 1989 by former ruler Omar al-Bashir in a military coup. The post of prime minister of Sudan was then abolished. Since his ouster, al-Mahdi continued to lead the Ummah Party, one of the largest opposition movements during Bashir's era, and spent a period in exile, but eventually returned to Sudan in the year 2000. He threw his weight behind the mass protest movement that eventually prompted the military to overthrow the president last year. After Bashir's ouster, al-Mahdi pushed for a transfer to civilian rule, warning of the risks of a counter-coup and calling for the powerful paramilitary rapid support forces to be integrated into the army. Al-Mahdi was also against the normalization of ties with Israel and supported the axis of resistance against the regime. In October, he slammed US President Donald Trump's announcement that Sudan would start normalizing ties with Israel. Al-Mahdi stressed that Trump's statement contradicts the Sudanese national law and contributes to the elimination of the peace process in the Middle East. He accused Trump of being racist against Muslims and described Israel as an apartheid regime. However, Sudan became the third Arab country to normalize ties with Israel after the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in August. Al-Mahdi warned that normalizing ties with Tel Aviv will prepare the ground for the ignition of a new war.
The coronavirus crisis has highlighted just how vulnerable the EU is when it comes to even the most basic healthcare requirements, such as having enough face masks. The bloc has also had to import ventilators and medication, mostly from China. The European Commission has just unveiled a pharmaceutical strategy aimed at making the EU less dependent.
We do not want to see, never again, the problems that we faced during the first weeks of the pandemic. Never again.
The plan is to ensure essential items are manufactured within the EU. The European Commission is also concerned that EU nations will not be ready to distribute vaccines when they become available in the coming weeks. Just half of the bloc's 27 nations have published plans. Countries are being told to redouble their efforts.
This means that member states cease to have the necessary infrastructure and the logistics, so when there is a safe and effective vaccine, they can roll it out and deploy it as quickly as possible.
Businesses are buckling under the pressure of lockdowns in many EU countries. The run-up to the December and January holiday period is normally their most profitable time. EU leaders continue to squabble over much-needed financial support packages for employers.
We've seen a major shock to the whole of the euro area, major trouble in Spain, in Italy, in other countries. I think the response was too weak.
Officials warn that if COVID-19 restrictions are relaxed too soon, hospitals will be overwhelmed during early 2021. It appears to be an impossible health-economy balancing act for governments. There is concern we are becoming complacent because we know vaccines are coming. Equally, authorities are worried too few of us will take advantage of the scientific breakthrough. The European Centre for Disease Control says each year hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers in the EU refuse to take the seasonal flu vaccine. It begs the question how many of them, and how many people in general, will agree to be injected with a COVID-19 vaccine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech,
the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.